Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. After the shooting of Michael Brown, an unarmed black man, by police, and the deaths of Freddie Gray and Eric Garner in police custody, America's underlying racial inequality has been thrust into the spotlight. While thousands of people protested or shared opinions about the brutality, others stood on the sidelines, having no idea how to talk about race. Among them, middle-class white Americans who'd be quick to say they aren't racist and think, this is not my issue or mess to clean up. Some may consider themselves colorblind, but remain oblivious to the experiences of people of color. Many are just afraid of saying the wrong thing. Debbie Irving grew up with the values and inherent privileges of her New England WASP class. She's now a racial justice advocate. Her memoir, Waking Up White, follows her realization that believing she's a good person with the empathy and energy to help people of color actually perpetuated her clueless notions of race. Debbie Irving, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So what does Waking Up White mean?
For me, it means waking up to the fact that I'm part of a history and a set of housing and lending and education and ongoing systems that through history have simultaneously advantaged white people. And I'm a member of the white race. I can't help but have benefited from that. And I knew nothing about it. So waking up means learning what I didn't know I didn't know.
And this began a long time ago, a question you asked your mother when you were just 5 years old. What happened to all the Indians? Now, what did she tell you, and what does that reveal about your upbringing?
She said to me, they drank themselves to death.
Wow.
And it's an appalling answer, and I will tell you that my mother was a wonderful person. She was highly educated. Private school, Smith College, empathetic, warm, never spoke poorly about people behind their back. And she said to me, you know, they were lovely people, and they just couldn't handle it. It brought them down. And what it reveals is the inherited ignorance, because she's not alive for me to ask, where did you ever get that story? But I can imagine, because I believed it when she said it to me. I believe that she believed it from someone else who told her, and maybe that person had very scarce information they were operating on. That is a tiny piece of a larger truth, but without the larger truth, that tiny piece paints a picture that portrays Indians as weak, and that is not the case.
Well, growing up in Winchester, Massachusetts, you learned, like many other WASPs, to stifle your feelings. Kind of grew up with this attitude of optimism, which was very different than that of those who, people of color in America, who are prepared for a hostile world. I'm thinking of, you know, Ta-Nehisi Coates in his recent memoir writes about his father beating with him with a belt and saying, you know, either I can beat him or the police.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what did that mean, having that attitude of optimism?
Well, it meant a lot of things. You know, for me, in addition to the world, the white bubble of the white suburb I was growing up in, the world was coming to me through television shows like Ozzie and Harriet and Leave It to Beaver and the Brady Bunch. And, you know, the biggest problems that were ever presented to me were solved in 30 minutes or less. And it also meant if I feel that I am in a world where anything is possible, that gives me a lot of wingspan in terms of dreaming and taking risks. And I did not have to worry when I stepped out of the house that I needed to be looking over my shoulder, or that I didn't have to contend because of my skin color with low expectations. I did have to do a little bit of that as a female, but never did I have to worry that people would think I was not smart or that I was uppity because of my skin color.
So much later, the awakening begins for you at a class at Wheelock College. And you eventually, in this book, you point to understanding whiteness as being a key to understanding racism. So what does whiteness mean to you?
Well, I think, so what's important to understand is that I spent 48 years thinking race and racism belonged to black and brown people. And I never thought to look within myself for answers. And what whiteness means to me is that it is the social construct that our country, that the United States of America, is founded on. And there was a legal category, white, that was invented in order to preserve resources and rights for white people. And so whiteness means all of that. And it means, if you look at the history of immigration, whiteness plays a huge role because it became paramount for anybody coming to this country whether or not they could be considered white. So Italian, Irish, Jews eventually were considered white. Other people who, we see it with the Latino population today, all kinds of Asian populations, lobbied to be considered white, and they weren't. And so they were denied citizenship, and they were subject to all kinds of stereotypes. But whiteness also includes all of the cultural norms that hold that in place. So avoidance of conflict is a key one. So if it's becomes normalized to not pose agitating questions in public, and the risk of doing that can ostracize you, you can lose your job, you can lose your status in a community, then we're not able to challenge the status quo. And that's a key component of whiteness.
And beyond the attitudes, our norms, there is a great deal of institutional racism that has maintained privilege for white people. What are some examples of that?
Well, there are current examples, but I think there's no better institutional example than the GI Bill and the way it played out after World War II. It feels long ago, but its remnants are largely responsible for what we see going on in neighborhoods that get fingered as violent and irresponsible, you know, ghettos today. Those were laid down in the mid-1900s. With housing and lending policies, where that lenders would not lend in neighborhoods where even one or two black families lived, whereas they would lend at low rates in neighborhoods like Winchester. So when you take a look at the GI Bill, this is how multiple institutions intersect. GI Bill says, hey, you World War II veterans coming home from the war, we're going to give you free higher education and low interest rate federal government-backed loans to buy a home. My father took advantage of both of those, Harvard Law School, home in Winchester. That bill was not available to 1 million, most of the 1 million black GIs who had also fought in World War II, because the loans would not go into a neighborhood where even one or two black families lived. And then on the education front, there was a quota system, and those spots filled up immediately. And there's even more to the story, but to give you a short version, that's how institutional racism works.
Well, I know that you are trying to normalize the conversation and get real with entangling and engaging in white privilege. But why do I feel weird and even suspect as one middle-class white woman talking to another? I'm in New Hampshire, among the whitest of states, about the realization of white privilege.
Why do you feel awkward? Is that the question when you're talking about it?
I guess it's a question for me, but you went through it, so I'd like to hear about your experience.
And I will tell you that white people all over the country are confessing to me, yeah, I feel that too. It's because we were taught not to talk about it. And if you're not talking about a subject, you have no language for it. Then you layer onto that that there is this norm about creating conflict and looking good. You know, you don't want to appear stupid, or you don't want to be offensive. You don't want to appear to be a boat rocker. So even bringing up the subject can be, uh-oh, here's a rabble rouser. Then you get in. I feel like it's a little bit like you learn a new language and you know how to say hello to someone. But as soon as they say something back to you, you go into paralysis because you don't know anything else other than hello. So that once you enter into these conversations, they are very likely to get rocky and contentious. And that if you're taught not to engage in conflict, you don't develop conflict navigation skills or even conversational skills that help us navigate through conflict. So I think that's why. And the other thing for me is that having been exposed to racial stereotypes my whole life, I can be sitting across the table talking to a good friend or colleague, even now, even after all the work I've done, and bubbling up into my head will be these negative stereotypes. And it makes me feel like a jerk. And oh my God, you know, what if one of these words slips out of my mouth when I'm in mid-conversation? So that's another layer. And those internalized ideas, images, words, that is natural. That does not make us bad. But it does, until we get in touch with them and say, wow, look at what all those cartoons and all that lack of exposure to positive images of black and brown people, look what it's done to me. If you can't get to the point of acknowledging that, then you sort of stuff down those biases and deny they exist. And I think that actually makes them try to bubble up harder and make those moments more awkward.
Well, I think it also makes me feel very self-conscious because we're taking this issue of race and, in a way, making it about us, the white people, again.
Mm. So there's a term for that, and that's called centering whiteness. And, you know, it threatens to, you know, recenter whiteness in a way that now white is the focus once again. And yet, it is crucial to understand how whiteness operates. If whiteness were not a thing, if race had not been invented by white people, racism, which is the ability to use power to enforce policy around race, if that had not been invented by white people, there would be nothing to discuss. And so it is the context. If we don't think of it as a center, but we think of it as the landscape, it is crucial to understand the landscape that creates discrimination, poverty, the achievement gap in education, differential lifespans. I know you had a show on last week talking about the way racism shows up in medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Every sector of our society suffers from a racial divide in terms of how people experience it and in terms of what outcomes are. There is one connecting landscape for all of that, one context for that, and that is whiteness. And that's why whiteness is so crucial to understand.
I'm speaking with Debbie Irving about her experience of growing up sheltered from genuine understanding of institutional racism and eventually coming to understand what it means to benefit from white privilege in America. Her new memoir is called Waking Up White. Well, you began to engage earnestly with people of color in classes and workshops and conferences. And, right, you know, sometimes it's cringeworthy reading this about how you've been humbled or humiliated even and forced to reckon with your own, your good intentions, your unconscious belief that you can help, that you have more to offer in this struggle for equality than someone who is less privileged. Can you give us an example of that and how that played out in your mind?
Yeah, and let me also add that I really identified as a good person because of that impulse. I thought that was what made me a good person, that desire to help and fix. And, well, one example, and this is in the book, is I was the general manager of First Night, and one of my charges was to bring together the multiple neighbors, the diverse neighborhoods of Boston, into a single New Year's Eve celebration. And I felt completely entitled to design the program without the input of a lot of people. And I had access, because of the social circles I'd grown up in, I had access to write grants and get money and, you know, raise the money to create these great quote-unquote inner-city programs. And my idea was, wouldn't it be great to partner these after-school programs, who were disproportionately black and brown children, with artists who were disproportionately white, have them create artworks and bring them down to the New Year's Eve celebration. So I thought that that was a great idea, and in some ways it was a good idea, but what I did not anticipate and was really hard for me to hear was that it was terrifying for those people who had been, for the children and the families, you know, their parents and their siblings, their aunts and uncles who had come down to the festival. It was terrifying for them to come into a huge white crowd, so that maybe making the art was interesting to them, but the actual experience of coming to the event was terrifying. That really sobered me.
You live in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and ask yourself, you know, despite living in this multicultural environment, do I always end up with white people? What is it that keeps white people in their enclaves? You mentioned earlier, you know, the fear of messing up or fear of saying the wrong thing. Is that it?
I think that's a part of it. You know, so we're talking about just that awkwardness. I'm afraid of saying something stupid or offensive. Well, when you're wanting to kind of let down your guard and hang out with your closest friends and family, that's not a time when you choose to be around people that you feel sort of an underlying nervousness around. So that was part of it for me. But the other part of it is people of color really you know, they have to be with white people. If they're trying to put together a living, they're educating themselves in white spaces, they're working in white spaces. When they need to unwind at the end of a day, they don't want to be around white people who really don't understand what racism is, how it works, or how even the most well-intentioned white person can be sort of oppressive. And, you know, white cultural norms are oppressive. We talk about the weather. We talk about light things. We deny racism exists. We say, oh, we're all the same. I love all people. We're all just human. Those are things that are surprisingly offensive. And so there's a culture clash. And at the end of the day, I think people of color are exhausted. They need to refuel. They do not need to be hanging out with white people. And that's, I'm not speaking for all people of color or all white people, but I think that that's a trend that keeps us separate. And I will tell you, my life has changed drastically. As soon as I could start talking about racism from my experience as a white person, as opposed to going, oh, that sounds terrible, what you have to go through, as soon as I could own my piece of it, all my relationships with friends of color changed almost overnight.
But isn't there a danger saying, you know, I want to live in a multicultural world with other people, of sort of crediting yourself with having all of these multicultural friends? You know, isn't that in itself a danger of stepping over this line of, oh, I belong, I'm cool, you know what I mean?
Yeah, like I'm accumulating friends and look at me, like it's a badge of honor. Yeah, I mean, I think that that is a danger. And I think that I was guilty of that earlier. I think it really changes when I hear the term multicultural, it means white as much as anything else. As soon as I start to say multicultural isn't something that belongs to other people, ethnicity isn't something that belongs to other people, race isn't something that belongs to other people only, but I'm a part of that formula. And in fact, my race, my ethnicity, my cultural piece that I bring to a multicultural environment is crucial for me to stay aware, be on top of, and be aware of. Then you move from accumulating multicultural friends to building authentic friendships.
Well, you know that police departments across the U.S. must be training their forces and having seminars on race and talking about racial identity, which is being talked about in the news. And a plurality of voices have joined the Black Lives Matter movement. What, Debbie, do you think this particular moment, this opportunity means for America going forward in a conversation about race?
Well, I think we've been here sort of many times before. And this is one of those classic moments where it's a crisis which presents an opportunity. And the question is this the moment where race will really be deeply understood, our racial history and the way it impacts individuals and the way we see ourselves and see the world around us? Or will it be a time to clamp down, increase controls, and double down on the oppressiveness that racism is? You know, there was slavery, that's off the books. There were Jim Crow laws, all kinds of segregationist policies, those are off the books. Now's the time to understand our history and the way it has impacted us psychologically, behaviorally, and in terms of the attitudes that we bring into the world. This is the big work. If we were in a marriage, it would be like, okay, the affair is over. Now let's dig into what that did to us. So it's a time to go inside, go deep, really understand the issue, and move forward in a multicultural way, not white people saying, here's how we're going to move forward, but really white people letting go and allowing multicultural committees, forums, boards, agencies. I mean, this is why diversifying is important. And then leveling the conversational playing field, changing the conversational power dynamics so that we can recreate the way America operates as a multicultural society. And there are some people who flat out don't want that. I'm more interested in talking to the people who want it but can't quite understand what undermines that intention.
Well, Debbie, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you for having me on.
Debbie Irving is author of the book Waking Up White, a memoir about her path to understanding the role racism played in her own life as a New England WASP. You can find more about her book at wordofmouthradio.org.